This is the Takeaway Podcast for Friday, August 14th, 2015. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Is a global recession looming? Nearly 8 years after the presidential campaign that brought Barack Obama into the White House? Nearly 8 years after the financial system buckled under a collapsing bubble of mortgage securities? Well, today we look to China for some very different but equally alarming rumbles. For months, China has been looking at declining sales of its exports and declining domestic demand for its goods. This week, it devalued the yuan, its currency, by about 4.4%. As manufacturing declines, the China industrial behemoth finds itself accumulating giant surpluses of raw materials. Pushing those surpluses out on the market is causing prices to plummet in many sectors around the world. And this discounting may turn things around for Chinese sales, but it is a direct shot to other global industries like the steel industry. China and Japan are the two biggest producers of steel in the world. But when both Asian giants start discounting the price of rolled steel and rebar and other steel, it hits home here in the U.S. steel industry, once the biggest in the world. I'm joined by Leo Gerard, International President of the United Steelworkers Union. President Gerard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you.
How much are you worried about what's going on in China right now?
I'm extremely worried, and I'm not only worried about the steel industry. The steel industry is obviously very, very vulnerable. China now is alleged, and I say alleged because they don't report everything, able to produce 1.1 billion, billion with a B, tons of steel, and that creates almost a 400 million ton overcapacity in China. And they're dumping that all over the world. But they're also doing the same thing. When you look at tire and rubber for automobiles, they're doing the same thing with paper. They're doing the same thing with aluminum. They're doing the same thing in almost every category. Plus, as you mentioned, they have devalued their currency. So they're causing disruptions in Europe. They're causing disruptions in America, in Mexico, in Latin America, and in Brazil. And something's got to be done to stop it. They've got to start playing by the rules.
So as you see it, Leo Gerard, China is doing what Standard Oil used to do a long time ago. When they can't necessarily increase demand, what they do is they go after market share by heavily discounting prices, except in this case, it's China, and they can do it on all kinds of commodities, and they're trying to grab market share even if they can't increase demand right away.
What they're actually doing is not only increasing market share, they're depressing the market all around the world, and they're in great possibility of causing a huge economic downturn in the world. We've been after the American government to do something about China's continuing devaluing of their currency. This is not the first time it's happened. It's happened several times where they've devalue their currency for a period of time. They come under pressure. They let it inch up a little wee bit, never back to the level it was at, and then they'll do it again. And the thing is, they don't play by any rules. Someone asked me once, how come the steelworkers win so many trade cases against the Chinese government? And the reason we do is because they cheat. Somehow, the American government has said that they want to leave the door open for China at some time in the future, joining the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We couldn't let that happen unless they're going to start to play by the rules and have an ability to enforce the rules. John, I mentioned the point of filing trade cases. To get from start to finish in a trade case can take upwards of 2 years. During that period of time, they keep flooding the market, keep depressing prices, keep, as you say, trying to get market share in a certain commodity. And what they do is they actually force the closure of manufacturing facilities in North America, in Europe, and other parts of the world. And that's very, very dangerous to the global economy.
Well, which is worse, Leo Gerard? I mean, the counterargument to you would be economists who say a trade war where tariffs go up everywhere would be hugely inflationary and would also reduce jobs.
Yeah, that, you know what? That's just straight up BS by these guys. You know, the fact of the matter is that we're in a trade war. We're in a trade war, and we're going into a gunfight with a slingshot. And if we want to have a global economy in the industrial economy of the world where the winner is the greatest cheater, then that doesn't spell very good for those of us that want to play by the rules. And those economists that do that, as I would always say, is follow the money. Figure out who's paying them for their studies. It's just not true.
Now, politically, the United States is a very different organized economy than the Chinese, given that they are communist and they're a one-party system and they're a controlled economy in to a much greater degree than the United States. Can they hold out longer than the United States if this becomes a game of chicken?
Well, I think that they're in deep trouble, and obviously the United States has to respond. But I think the United States has to create a atmosphere where the Europeans will also be part of that response, where the Brits will be part of that response, where Mexico and Canada will be part of that response. This is happening not just in America, although America's taken it the worst. Others have some ability to get to a remedy quicker than we do. But that has to happen. And the other thing, John, if you go from the time that we allowed the Chinese into the so-called WTO, and you take the accumulated trade deficits from that point on, in my world, the trade deficit is simply a wealth transfer that we owe them. We've transferred wealth to them by buying more from them than we sell them. So we're transferring wealth. During that period of time since they joined the WTO, China has accumulated almost $7.5 trillion of unpaid, if they want to call it that, trade deficits. We've transferred wealth to China that has allowed them to accelerate the manufacturing of their economy faster than ours.
Let's come back to the question of what can be done here. There have been tariffs imposed on China. What's been the impact as far as you can see?
Look, I think that we're talking to the administration. The steel industry is. Some other industries are. What we need is a better system of enforcement. We've proposed to the administration an enforcement package that once you've been named as a cheater, you can do something. We need to have the American government name China as a currency manipulator. We need to have a dialogue with Europeans and the Brits to do the same thing over there, because we've got to bring that system that they're using to grow their industrial base at the expense of the rest of the world. We've got to bring that to a conclusion. You hit it right on the introduction. They play by a different set of rules. They have a different timetable, and they've got to keep their economy growing at somewhere between 7% and 9%. Otherwise, they're going to have people in the streets. They don't want people in the streets. They want our people in the streets. In fact, they want our people not to be able to have an income. If that's okay, they'll just sell us junk.
Let's, in the final seconds that we have here, I just want to ask you a question. I don't want to sound like, you know, Glenn Beck or anything here, but, you know, when you hear American political leaders talk about China, you know, it's always in the tone of we have to respect China, we have to acknowledge they're a world power, we have to work with them. The world peace depends upon a cooperative arrangement with China. There seems to be a lot of concern, almost a fear of being intimidated by China. Why aren't you afraid of China?
I'm not afraid of China because all we're doing is enforcing the rules. China agreed, but to play by a set of rules. Look, first of all, I don't believe in the WTO. That's a much longer story, but it's there. China wanted to be a part of that. America helped them become a part of the WTO. And in that process, they agreed to play by a set of what I'll call global rules. They don't play by those rules. So I'm not afraid of asking someone, or in this case, a country that said, we'll play by the rules. I'm not afraid of asking them to play by the rules. When we take trade case after trade case after trade case to the trade tribunal, we're not asking them to do anything but enforce the rules. It'd be no different than if you had a stop sign or a street light on a very busy corner and you said, everybody else has got to stop, but these guys don't. They can just drive right through. And then you decide you're going to enforce the rules. Is there something wrong with that? I don't think so. Not only that, I wasn't elected by Chinese government. I was elected by working people in North America, and they expect me and they expect this union to fight for them, and that's what I'm going to do.
How close are you to picking up the phone and calling the longshoremen and trying to prevent Chinese steel from landing at U.S. ports?
Well, as I said earlier, it's not just an issue of Chinese steel. The longshoremen have their job. It's an issue of the Chinese economic model doesn't work for the rest of the world. They create global overcapacity. They use that global overcapacity to keep their people employed, but they dump that overcapacity into the global marketplace, whether it's steel, whether it's paper, whether it's copper, whether it's aluminum. We got to force them through the global means to play by a set of rules, and we got to quit transferring our wealth to them.
Leo Gerard, International President of the United Steelworkers Union, thanks so much.
Thank you. Good to be on with you.
There are three cherry perfect vintage Chevy Impalas parked in front of the U.S. Embassy in Havana, Cuba this morning. For the first time since January 4th, 1961, an American flag flies over that embassy. Secretary of State John Kerry is the first Secretary of State to set foot on the island since March of 1945. It's a symbolic step, the beginning of a working relationship in the Caribbean after nearly 55 years as the U.S. and Cuba were Cold War enemies. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick had a chance to speak with Congressman Jim McGovern, Democratic representative for Massachusetts, who is with John Kerry as part of the U.S. delegation in Havana. Todd, how excited was Jim McGovern to be a part of this moment?
Oh, Jim McGovern has a long history in Cuba. We'll talk about it. He's really excited. He's down there with a small delegation, four senators, five congressmen with Kerry. I asked McGovern what this moment meant, and to him, it's really the end of the Cold War.
We're doing more than raising flags at embassies. I mean, we're actually beginning to establish kind of a relationship with Cuba that I think can be helpful in a number of areas. Whether it's to deal with issues of human rights or environmental concerns or drug interdiction or migration, or when you have a formal embassy, you then have a direct relationship with the government. So I think we'll see progress on that. I think you'll see progress, a limited amount of trade as a result of some executive actions that the president has made.
You know, it's remarkable that the Cold War has been over for such a long time. It's really playing catch up in some ways, this relationship between the U.S. and Cuba.
Yeah, it is. And McGovern is one of the people who sort of tie this new engagement with Cuba in with other forms of engagement, some of which are controversial, like the nuclear deal with Iran. Being able to talk to your adversaries, not necessarily get cozy and friendly with them, but have a relationship. Listen.
It signals that we're now at a point where we believe that engagement is important, that rather than issue press releases and give fiery speeches when we disagree with the Cuban government, that we will now behave like grown-ups and actually talk to them directly, and they will talk to us directly. And I believe that that will open the way for, you know, lots of progress on a number of fronts. It's now up to Congress to take the next step, which is to lift the embargo. The people who are defending the status quo are stuck in this Cold War mentality that somehow this policy is effective, when the reality has been that it's been a miserable failure. It's time for change. It's time to move on. It's time for us to be adult about this and have a mature relationship where we can actually talk about our differences.
Now, John McGovern is one of the people who needs to be realistic about those differences and how much progress can be made. I'll remind you that Marco Rubio, a Cuban-American presidential candidate, is making a speech today on what he would do if he were president. He would ratchet up pressure on Cuba and on Iran. And there are a lot of hurdles that remain. He mentioned the embargo. The Republican Congress, John, is not interested in lifting the trade embargo now. Only Congress can do that. This Congress is not going to approve a new U.S. ambassador to Cuba. On the Cuban side, John, Cuba wants Guantanamo Bay naval base, not just where the detainees are, but the whole naval base. They want that back. They're not going to get it anytime soon. They're not going to get reparations. There are a host of other issues between our two countries. McGovern's optimistic about the possibility of talking about some of those issues and about trade, but hopefully he's realistic about what can really be done in the next 2 years here.
I'm just wondering, we've heard so much about the differences between the U.S. and Cuba. Maybe it's time to start talking about the similarities, the cultural parallelisms, the common history that we have, the kinds of things that in a mature relationship are really going to build trade and build prosperity between the two countries.
Well, McGovern and John Kerry and the rest of the delegation today, John, after the flag raising, are headed to a second stop. It's Hemingway House, about a half an hour outside of Havana, where Ernest Hemingway lived. Now, Hemingway is extremely popular in Cuba, just like here in the United States. Jim McGovern has a long history with this. You know, about 12 years ago, he got wind that Hemingway House was in disrepair, the documents were falling apart, and he formed a nonprofit organization that raised some money to try to get Hemingway House with Cuban partners back up and running. It is today, and today they're going there. Now, he explained what happened 12 years ago when he helped raise this private money for Hemingway House. Listen.
So we kind of put together a little contract, and they wanted me to sign it, but they wanted me to sign it at the house. And so we went to the house, and there were all these security all around the place and all these cameras, and Fidel Castro comes walking out, and he and I signed the agreement together. which was a little bit of a surprise. But what was fascinating about that was that Castro mentioned, said two things that I thought were interesting. One, he said he really never got to know Hemingway, even though he had a house there, that he met Hemingway once. It was at a fishing contest and basically said, nice fish, but figured he'd be back and he'd get to talk to Hemingway about all of his writings and, what motivated him to write some of the things that he did. But Hemingway left and then, he died and never came back. So Castro said, well, after that, I made sure that anybody interesting who came to the island, that I actually talked to them because, who knows if I'll ever see them again. But then he also said he read Old Man of the Sea again. He reread it. And he said that it meant something very different to him. This was about 12 years ago than it did when he first read it because he was older.
Well, if they refurbish Hemingway House, I hope they, well stock it with rum. That's authentic and cigars and the kinds of things that Hemingway loved that probably contributed to his demise. But those were amazing times. And I think for Americans to remember that cultural affinity is going to be really, really important as we think about the human rights issues and some of the other issues that are going to be more complicated going forward.
There are a lot of tough issues between these countries that are left. McGovern said he was in Cuba in 1979, John, when the Soviet Union dominated that country. There was no political debate at the time. He said things are much better now, that there's more ability in Cuban society. It's not like American democracy. There are problems there, especially from the American point of view. But there is space for a new debate on this. Listen.
Notwithstanding the fact that there are still some very significant human rights problems on the island, there's more political space in Cuba than there was in 1979. There's more political space in Cuba, quite frankly, than in a lot of the countries that we consider our allies. So, if we want to make progress on human rights, I think engagement is a far better way to do that than isolating them or, giving these speeches where politicians get up and rattle the sabers and embolden and strengthen the hardliners in Cuba.
A historical moment, just the beginning between a relationship between U.S. and Cuba restored after so many years. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
You got it, Sean.
For many of you parents at home, when playtime is over in a household of boys and girls, Barbie gets tossed into the jumbled toy box with G.I. Joe. The fast cars and the cute ponies are all thrown in together. The stuffed animals sleep happily with the fierce plastic dinosaurs. Even though such toys were bought in different aisles of the department store, boys' stuff and girls' stuff, their fate is to end up all in the same box, just like in Toy Story. So whose idea was it to segregate the toys in the toy store, even though they all get mixed up when they become toy stories? Well, Target stores, in response to online consumer shaming, says there should be no toy segregation anymore. Target has decided to go along with a trend taking hold elsewhere. A Let Toys Be Toys movement in Britain is changing how some department stores there categorize play items. Some religious conservatives think they know where the practice of separating girl and boy toys came from. Franklin Graham, reacting to the Target decision this week, said it was Jesus who arranged the toys when he spoke in the Bible, Matthew 19, verse 4. Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? I didn't know Jesus ever worked at Target.
This is Wendy calling from Flushing. I think it is time that we revamp our approach to childhood toys. Because considering my 3.5-year-old daughter, she's all about dinosaurs, which I know are gender neutral, but any dinosaur t-shirt I've ever found is in the boy section. And also, I have a 14-month-old son who loves nothing more than to pour me pretend tea in his older sister's purple tea set.
This is Catherine from Dallas. What difference does it make whether a doll is pink or blue or a truck is blue or pink? Kids play with toys, period.
Lise Elliott is a neuroscientist and author of Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. She says the discovery of gender by little kids is a small, unpredictable mystery with big consequences.
Far and away, the bigger influence over toy preference is social learning. And the reason we know that is when kids are young and before they go to preschool, and particularly if they don't have parents that are training them what to play with, they will play with everything. Kids are very exploratory. They get bored with one toy and they'll move on to the next, assuming nobody's looking over their shoulder, staring at them for playing with the wrong color toy. And once kids go to preschool and they're in large groups of peers who've been more indoctrinated into the pink or blue, that's when they start to shun the so-called gender inappropriate toy.
So Target may be onto something here in terms of, separating toys you know, may actually reduce sales, that if you mix them up, there's less of that feeling of having someone look over your shoulder. If you're a boy staring at the girl's aisle and a girl staring at the boy's aisle, there's less anxiety. You can just choose exactly what you want to play with rather than worry about the category.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's a smart move because we know there's a lot of books out now about boys who are not fitting into the absolute masculine model, and, you know, with the whole transgender movement, who love pink and sparkly. There's a book called My Princess Boy. There's other clothing lines now that allow boys to wear pink and allow girls to wear shirts with dinosaurs on them and space images. Most people think that the gender segregation of toys actually was fueled by manufacturers so that they could essentially sell twice as many toys. Because if something like a bicycle or a lunchbox or a toy phone comes in two different colors, you know, an older sister's not going to be able to hand that down to a younger brother. And so companies thought they could sell twice as much.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, is it possible that having this non-segregated world of gender items, of toys, et cetera, will allow children to explore their ambiguities about gender without having a lot of anxiety, and that parents can see things differently than just they're being, you know, they're being put into a category that they don't like, that there's somehow a different way of coming forward with one's own particular, you know, gender ambiguity, be it transgender, be it sexual preference, that sort of thing?
You know, I don't actually think that breaking down the boy and girl aisles at Target or anywhere else is going to suddenly increase the number of, you know, transgender children.
No.
The truth is that what you play with doesn't shape your sexuality. It doesn't shape your gender identity. But what it does do is help your brain practice certain skills. So if you're playing with blocks and building toys, Legos, you're going to develop a certain set of spatial skills that's very helpful when you get around to math class and geometry and physics. And if you're going to play with baby dolls, you're going to develop a certain set of nurturing skills that's going to be very handy when you get around to being a parent. So I just view toys as a big, huge playground that allows children to exercise every part of their brain. And if you draw a sharp line and only let certain children play with certain toys and vice versa, you're going to limit their skills down the line.
Finally, I'm amazed. I have three girls and two boys at, you know, how the conditioning can actually get through, even if as parents you think you're trying to prevent these categories from being apparent to kids. They get signals very, very subtly and conclude things that you never thought you taught them.
Yes, right. So gender, as we understand it, is actually a spectrum. And we all have certain features that are masculine and feminine to different degrees. But children don't get that. They're little minds think much more clearly in opposites. So gender is actually one of the first opposites they learn. Even before they're 1 year of age, children understand the difference between male and female faces and voices. And so once they get to this age close to three, where they're starting to figure out their own gender, it's a very black and white or pink and blue kind of issue. You're either one thing or the other thing. If you wear pink, that makes you a girl, no matter what you're wearing under your underwear. And so it can be very frustrating for parents to try to teach children the nuance when everything in the culture is screaming, you know, boy or girl.
Lise Elliott is Associate Professor of Neuroscience at the Chicago Medical School and author of Pink Brain, Blue Brain, How Small Differences Grow into Troublesome Gaps and What We Can Do About It. Thanks, Lise.
Thank you.
What do you think, Rochester, New York? Change the stigma. Dolls teach boys empathy. Trucks teach girls they can be tough. I don't know. In my neighborhood, boys launched Barbies into the neighbor's yard with catapults, and girls loaded trucks with stuffed bunnies and baby dolls. Livermore, California, keep making blue toys and pink toys and let kids choose to play with whatever they want. How can it possibly matter what color a toy is? Girls can play with trucks. Boys can play with dolls. If it makes them happy, why would anyone question that?
Larry Mayer, Staten Island. By providing gender-specific play materials to our children before they clearly understand how their gender affects the social order, does a disservice by prescribing socially dictated gender roles. This is why there is great disparity in adulthood between men and women in who enters which occupations? My answer is definitely not to gender-specify play materials in early childhood development.
Keep the conversation going. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. This is how history tells us that World War II ended. A relentless Allied leap from island to island across the Pacific ends with the burning of Tokyo and atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The Japanese simply were brought to their knees and surrendered.
Pearl Harbor was avenged, and the news triggered the greatest celebration the nation has ever known.
The battleship Missouri, 53,000-ton flagship of Admiral Halsey's Third Fleet, becomes the scene of an unforgettable ceremony marking the complete and formal surrender of Japan.
In Chicago, tears of joy mingled with cheers as a million people sang and danced in the streets.
New York City, as throughout a rejoicing nation and world, vast throngs of grateful, happy people celebrate the end of fighting, the dawn of peace.
That voice on a scratchy vinyl disc broadcast over Japanese NHK radio was the only thing that could have ended the war. The voice was not a weapon, not a warning, not some Allied propaganda. It was the voice of the beloved Japanese Emperor Hirohito, a voice the Japanese had never heard before. That's how close to a god, a purely spiritual figure, he was. Only the Emperor could end the war, and it almost didn't happen 70 years ago today. What most Americans don't know is that as the atomic bombs were falling, the Japanese were trying to get the Soviets into the war in the Pacific to fight the Americans. Toshi Hasegawa, a professor of history at University of California, Santa Barbara, was a little boy at the time. He says this was the desperate gambit Japan was using to try and keep the Americans at bay, even though their nation was in flames.
August 9th, at this time, the Japanese government is trying to terminate the war through Soviet mediation. And only after the Soviet entered the war, then that last hope was dashed. You see, the Soviet entry into the war was a shock to the Japanese government, much bigger than the Hiroshima bomb. And so this is the first time they decided to terminate the war. And then the highest decision-making body of Japan was the Supreme War Council. And they were divided about what conditions that they are going to attach. The ultimate upshot is that they could not decide. Therefore, they just brought the decision to the Imperial Conference on the night of August 9th and continued to August 10th. And that's where the Emperor had this voiced opinion. It's called the voice of Ukraine, and decided to terminate the war with one condition. One condition that the Imperial prerogatives would not be infringed upon. So that's the first Imperial Conference. First conditional acceptance of Potsdam Conference.
Now, that happened on the 10th. Explain this voice of the crane idea.
Voice of crane, because I think that the emperor, by tradition, was not supposed to get involved in a real decision-making process. But the situation was such at that time, this unprecedented crisis, and the cabinet and Supreme War Council was divided. They could not come to any conclusion. So that's the only option that was open. Let the emperor decide on this matter. And the emperor decided to accept the Potsdam Conference and then terminate the war.
The emperor, you see, understands that the options have run out, but others still want to fight. And here is where reality in Tokyo and in the United States diverge for a few critical days. This is what people heard on August 10th, 1945, on NBC Radio.
WEAF, New York.
Good morning, everybody. We are here in the NBC newsroom with the bulletins coming in constantly on Japan's surrender offer. And with every minute that passes, it seems more certain that the offer is definite and that there is a 9 out of 10 chance that it will be accepted.
Among Japanese and American negotiators, a surrender agreement was being worked out. Keeping Hirohito as nominal leader of Japan was the sticking point. Time passed, but weary Japanese citizens were told in their newspapers that they would fight on, down to the last man.
They read the war minister's announcement that they are going to fight the war to the very bitter end. So that's a really sort of colorful language. Even if that we chew the grass and then eat the dirt and then and crawl on the ground, we're going to continue to fight the war. And so that's what the Japanese people read in the newspaper.
Chewing grass and eating dirt. Hirohito understood just how powerful that language was and how loyal the Japanese people would be even in a lost cause. He would need to be what's called the voice of the crane, an ancient Japanese tradition of speaking over the disagreements of people to bring unity in a time of emergency. Hirohito called in NHK Radio to record a public announcement, surrendering without condition.
His real voice was never spoken to the Japanese people, so that's a totally unprecedented event. That National Broadcasting Company officials and then technicians were ordered to come to the Imperial Palace and to record the Empress. And then, of course, everybody's very, very nervous. And by then, they knew that rebel soldiers are going to come to the Imperial Palace. And so that in the secretly, they broadcast actually precisely between 11:15 and 11:45 at night on August 14th. And he recorded the Imperial rescript twice. So the technicians put all those records. Actually, they made four records and then put that in a sack and put that in a safe and then hid it, concealed it. And so the rebel soldiers came, looked all over to find that the recording device because they knew that the emperor had recorded. And so that if the Imperial rescript is broadcast, then that would be the end of the game. So they looked all over. They could not find it.
It was a bloody scene at the palace that night, with a number of palace guards being taken down by the attacking officers. They were seeking supporters and those precious vinyl recordings, but they failed. And so the rebels attacked the last place where they could hold back surrender, the radio studios of NHK.
Those junior conspirators slipped out of the Imperial Palace and gathering some troops and tried to attack the NHK headquarters and came to the confront the broadcasters. The officials on the broadcasting, they are using the technical details to resist that demand that the broadcast should be suspended and protected the record, protected that the broadcast.
Because of the bravery of that announcer with the pistol to his head and the engineer who disconnected the studio from the antenna, the coup fizzled out. And at exactly noon on August 15th, the Japanese heard their emperor's voice in a moment that became known as the Jewel Voice Broadcast.
To our good and loyal subjects, after pondering deeply on the general trend of the world and the actual conditions pertaining to our empire today, we have decided to effect a settlement of the present situation by resorting to an extraordinary measure. We have ordered our government to inform the government of the United States, Britain, China, and the Soviet Union that our empire accepts the provisions of their joint declaration, the Potsdam Declaration.
I was a young boy, didn't understand what was going on, but I knew that although all the adults sat around the radio and listened to this, and then they their tears. But I think my guess is that many people were relieved that the war was over.
A war ends, but history does not. We thank our candid historian guide, Toshi Hasegawa, history professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. To hear the full translated speech of Hirohito's Jewel Voice broadcast, go to thetakeaway.org. You can also see a timeline of the events on our site and listen or comment on anything you've heard. And if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast, find us on iTunes, and take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.